Hello. This is Crude X, Murder in an Oil Town, and you're listening to episode 7 of our series, Who Killed Debbie and Sandy? Thank you for sticking with us. On our last episode, we started going over a report of a deathbed confession by a man who had been a person of interest in the case for several years. This man's name was Bobby Jarvis, and in his report, he implicates two men as being responsible for the murders. And that was person of interest, Bob Bass, and his brother, Jimmy Bass. We're halfway through picking apart this report, sorting out truth from lies told by what we all know was a well-known con man, trying to solve the question of whether this report provides answers or just more riddles to solve. So, without further ado, we've got a lot to go over, so let's just dive right in. I'm Jen Schaefer, and this is Crude Acts, Murder in an Oil Town, Who Killed Debbie and Sandy, Part 7. Just a recap of our last episode, I read you a police report from 1991. It was taken by Officer Gene Parker upon information he received from Lieutenant J.C. Deal about a confession by none other than Bobby Jarvis. He stated that he was there when Debbie and Sandy were killed, and he knew who was responsible. We got about halfway through the report, picking it apart in an attempt to discover who, what, when, where, and why the murders occurred and how much we can trust from the information that was given. Bobby Jarvis was a known con man with little conscience, little empathy, and on top of it, the report was relayed by his wife of about 15 years, and that was to J.C. Deal, a police officer who was tight with Jarvis and possibly more than likely a dirty cop. Jarvis stated in the report that it was Jimmy Bass, brother to Bob Bass, who was responsible for the murders. Jarvis gave a ridiculous reason for it, that it was either because the women were insulting his manhood, this made Jimmy mad and he shot them, which doesn't make sense, or it was about some money that was taken or owed, which of course, if this were the case, seems a lot more likely. But what we know is Jarvis himself was the one who basically stole a lot of money from Bob Bass, selling him bad bookkeeping gambling books. So that doesn't make sense. Why would the women have to pay the price for that? So that's something that we'll just have to look into later on. According to the CI, who we believe is Linda Jarvis, the only people who were present when it happened was Bob Bass, Jimmy Bass, and Bobby Jarvis. And then later, Gary Odom arrived after he got off work at Texas Saloon, and he helped them dump the bodies in Chambers County, and they used a Jeep that they borrowed from a man named Jack Lane, who owned Jack Lane Used Cars off of 205 North Alexander, which was less than a mile away from the trailer, and they also used a white van to transport them, and of course, the white van, we assume, belonged to Mickey Crawford. The CI said in the report that they were both shot, which is weird, because what I heard from police and from my dad, who was the investigator, they believed that Debbie was actually stabbed multiple times and Sandy was shot. And speaking of being shot, that brings us to the gun that was used, and this gets confusing. The CI, Linda Jarvis, stated Bobby Jarvis traded a handgun with Gary Odom prior to the women being shot, and then they swapped back after. That doesn't make sense either. And then she stated that Bobby Jarvis was arrested on a narcotics conspiracy charge. And now this is something that we know about. I looked this up in the Baytown Sun, and it was on September 17th, 1987. The Sun reported that charges of possession of a controlled substance were filed in the 177th District Court against Bobby Jarvis of 1800 Bowie School Road and Gary Stephen Odom of 407 East Vale Street. The fine was $2,000. So the guys had been manufacturing and selling methamphetamines for a while, and it was confirmed from a source that Jarvis cooked meth on someone's property out in Chambers County back in the day in like a shipping container or some sort of building like that. And then even later, when he moved to Mineola, Texas, he cooked meth out there as well. So Jarvis was arrested, and then he's apparently, he states this to her, right? He's apparently worried about a gun that was found in his home, and he said that that wasn't the murder weapon. And he was also questioned extensively about the murders at that time and was concerned about this gun. Then, according to Linda Jarvis, Bobby Jarvis either pawned it or sold it or had someone pawn it or sell it for him. And that was at a pawn shop in Dayton. And again, all that information sounds like a mix of lies and truth. But of course, this is also fourth-hand information passed from Bobby Jarvis to Linda Jarvis, Linda Jarvis to J.C. Deal, and J.C. Deal to Gene Parker, who wrote the report and filed it in 1991. I've read this police report over and over, and with supplement information I've discovered, I personally think this confession, so to speak, was really all just a lot of fabrication, a tall Texas tale. And I'm going to explain why, okay? And it comes with a few different things. So first, let's look at who supposedly provided this information. It's Bobby Jarvis, who is a shady character, a liar, a no-good son of a gun, a man who was described by every single person that I've talked to as a horrible human with zero empathy or compassion. He didn't need to do this to clear his conscience because Bobby Jarvis didn't have one. He didn't want to help solve anything. He wasn't doing this for the police. Bobby Jarvis did things for Bobby Jarvis, for his own benefit, and that's it. What was there to gain for him by providing this information? Absolutely nothing. So, second, the stories in the report just seem far-fetched and unrealistic, like out of a mafia movie or something. The information was passed on four times before it was written, and then the middleman was Lieutenant J.C. Deal. This man was close friends with Jarvis, and it seems to me as if he was possibly crooked with something to gain because he was covering for those in the network who were still alive at the time. Third, and this is interesting, there are contradictory stories about Bobby Jarvis's death. I heard that he died immediately. Without warning, he died while standing up, someone said. I also heard from another person that he had cancer, and they told them this in 1987. Then I heard from someone else that in 1985, when they met him, he was going around telling people that he was going to die then of a heart attack. And then I received a copy of his death certificate, and I'm going to share a shot of that on YouTube. If you've been keeping up to date with this, I make YouTube videos that show pictures and the reports and all kinds of things. But when you look at the death certificate on YouTube, you'll see it looks like a fake. The fonts are way off and definitely not typewriter font. And mind you, this was 1991 in Mineola, Texas. So that to me seems very fishy. And then we'll go into that later because I don't want to expound on something that I don't know anything about. So first glance, looks fishy, looks like a fake. Lastly, and this is something new that has substantiated my belief that the report is a bunch of BS. And it's a conversation that I had recently. We're talking like a few days ago with none other than Bob Bass himself. It took me a while to call him back because we played phone tag for a little bit. I was actually pretty nervous to talk to him. So we go back and forth, calling each other, leaving voicemails. We even text. And so like 2 days ago, we ended up talking on the phone. And we talked for over 2 hours. And in those 2 hours, I learned a lot. Come to find out, Bob Bass wasn't this mythic money man that the folks of Baytown thought he was. He wasn't JR from Dallas walking around Baytown bars with a briefcase full of money. He was just a guy whose family lived in Baytown. He was actually born in Baytown, but moved away as a kid. He came back to Baytown after living in Tulsa. And the reason he came back was to help his father with his small oil business that was failing at the time. Apparently, his dad had a magical way with people, but wasn't so great with numbers. In 1985, Bob Bass lived with his folks out in Humble, where the business was and still is, and he also stayed part-time with his uncle and aunt, Roseanne and Joe Dacey, in Baytown. He drove a green Mercedes at the time, and that belonged to his ex-wife. Bob admitted back in the 80s that he was young and dumb and partied with alcohol and cocaine, and he got into the Baytown nightlife. He became friends with Gary Odom, who actually worked for him as a mechanic. He said Gary was such a likable guy, and he had a good heart despite all of his addictions and issues. He would often go out to the bars to hear Gary play with his band, and Texas Saloon was one of them, and he would go there to shoot pool and hang out with some of his workers. I asked him if he remembered the name Jimmy Tippett. He said he kind of remembered the name, but not really. He didn't think he hung out with him or anything. But I told Bob about his police report and how he told them that he, Bob Bass, bought Gary Odom's daughter a car. And I wanted to ask him about that because that's weird. And Bob's answer to that was no. He stated that he and Gary were just party friends and he didn't even know he had a daughter or that he was even married because he sure didn't act like it. I told him that Jimmy also told the police that he stole from him. He stole money and he stole cocaine. And he said, what? That's weird. I said, yeah, he took it out of your ceiling at the Lone Star Beer Distributorship. And he goes, oh, I wonder how he knew I kept it up there. But he didn't even know about it. And he was just kind of laughed it off. You know, it was a long time ago and he's not interested in that sort of thing anyway. But back then he was, and I told him, and that's that story. Then I went on to ask him other names like Jim Gerace and Nick Listy, and he told me something interesting about them. He said that he had an early run-in with those guys when he first rolled into town. When he moved back to Baytown to help out his dad with his business, he also promised his dad that he would help out his Uncle Joe with his business as well. Joe owned the Lone Star Beer Distributorship, and it was in a hole. Times were tough. Joe was too generous with his money, and he didn't keep a close eye on his books. And it seems like he was possibly getting ripped off by his employees, and that even included Bob Bass's brother, David Pryor. Because of the money problems, the beer distributorship was up for sale, and Jim Gerace was slated to buy it. But before he could close in on it, Bob Bass swooped in, secured the money he needed to buy it from a local bank, and he did this quickly and right out under Jim Gerace's nose. He said Jim Gerace was super mad about it. He really wanted that business and that building. And from then on, those guys didn't care much for old Bob Bass. So I, of course, asked him about the women, Debbie Merritt and Sandy Terrell. He told me, just like he told the police, that he never knew them. Kind of recalled seeing them around. He remembered the pictures. He's like, I'm having trouble picturing them, but He didn't even know the depths of the tragedy of what happened. And he even learned more because my father had a conversation with him after I had a conversation with him. So we both wanted to talk to him and kind of compare notes and to see how we felt about this guy, Bob. And I guess we both were on the same page and we believed him. Then I asked Bob Bass about Bobby Jarvis. And he said, oh, that name sends shivers down my spine. He is pure evil. And Bob said when he first hung out with Jarvis at his condo in Baytown, then this is his first time meeting him there. There in the corner of his dining room was a big old machine gun. And he said it scared him and that he knew he was bad news and he should have stayed away. He was warned about Bobby Jarvis by other friends of his. But just like Jimmy Tippett said in his report, Bob Bass said he got involved with Bobby Jarvis and his bookmaking schemes. And he said he lost a ton of money in a short amount of time and then he cut Jarvis off and quickly got out of it. This made Jarvis upset. And Bob said he was scared of him retaliating and avoided him from there on out as much as he could. I then told Bob Bass about Bobby Jarvis's deathbed confession and that he named him and his brother Jimmy as the guys who killed Debbie Merritt and Sandy Terrell. And Bob was shocked. He reacted in a way that I feel anyone who was blamed for something that they didn't do, how they would react. He emphatically denied it. I asked him, did he ever go out to Gary Odom's trailer? It was the one behind his garage. And he said, yeah, he did. He'd been there a few times. I asked him if his brother ever came into town. And he said, yes, his brother came into town to help him with the Lone Star business in particular, as well as their dad's business. I said, did your brother know these people? He's like, not very well, but he did go out a few times. I asked him if Jimmy ever went to the trailer. And he said, yeah, I think he did. He did like once or twice, not a lot though. He was very open and very honest about it. And I told him in the report that Jarvis stated that it was in the trailer where the killings occurred. And oh my God, he said, well, we had absolutely nothing to do with that. And I didn't even know any of these details until you've just told me now. So with the report and all the questions and with the conversation with Bob Bass and all of his openness and willingness to even call me and talk to me, it really does seem, and listener, you can put this together yourself as well. Could it be that this report was simply a red herring? This deathbed confession, was it just a distraction for law enforcement, a diversion? I'll tell you, all that came from it was the Texas Rangers got the information, went out to Mineola to talk to Linda Jarvis, and then that was it. Mind you, my dad was already off the case. He was out of homicide altogether. He moved to auto theft. And shortly after, David Maxwell was taken off the case and moved to another one in another territory in Texas. So after their talk with Linda and a follow-up with the report, no one followed up with it from there. And the case died out and got buried and forgotten. Here's the kicker. No one ever reached out to Bob Bass about it. No one reached out to Bob Bass about the report. He didn't know anything of it until I mentioned it to him. I'll say this. Further conversation with Bob Bass led to some interesting information. And he referred to the group of bar owners that we've talked about, the network that I've been piecing together. He referred to them as a little mafia. It was Jim Gerace, Bobby Jarvis, and Nick Listee. And he brought up another guy that was not really on my radar and I hadn't done much digging into, and I just beginning with that, but that's Nick Listee's son, Dane Listee. So apparently he was in his late 20s, going on early 30s, and he was part of the group too. And we'll go more into him later on. But Bob Bass stated he knew these guys in this little mafia, but he stated he didn't even know the depths of this little mafia's illegal activities, but he figured it was pretty deep. And it's the primary reason he got out of Baytown altogether just a few years later. And from what I've researched, it seems it's a fortunate thing that Bob trusted his instincts. So the question is, what was the illegal activity? And I've touched on some of it through speculation, but let's go deeper with this and let's really start to understand what was going on. To understand what was happening back then, you need to understand where and when it all happened. So where, that's Baytown, Texas. A little 1-2 punch about Baytown. Baytown, Texas is about 30 miles southeast of Houston. It's outlined by Highway I-10 and Highway 146. It was largely undeveloped and isolated until around 1916 when Ross S. Sterling founded Humble Oil, which would later become Exxon. The Tri-Cities, which became Baytown, grew up and around it, and Humble Oil ran everything. They paved the streets, they provided the utilities, they were the banks, they were the stores, they were the police force, they were everything. Humble Oil was Baytown, Baytown was Humble Oil. One didn't stop where the other one didn't start, and vice versa. Now, here's the thing, that of course came with some problems. Humble Oil took advantage of their workers, and early on, a strike over management policies, poor working conditions, and inflation in their banks, that went underway. And the higher-ups' response to it was to bring in army troops to, quote, maintain order. And sadly, the intimidation worked. And they, quote, negotiated with the Department of Labor in January 1918. They drafted a settlement that rejected all significant union demands. Favor fell in the way of Goliath, not so much David. And from there, this set up a grand hierarchy from which we could safely say that Baytown and even much of Texas has successfully maintained layers, if you will, that have hardened and petrified over time as the establishment. And that is why you don't see much in the way of change in Texas. Now, I want to talk about these layers in Texas oil towns and how they're structured. So, right at the top are the big money men, the bankers, the landowners, the tycoons who run everything. They run everything from businesses to political offices. These folks are oil town royalty, and they are steeped in a privilege they don't recognize because it is woven not only into their DNA, but in the DNA of the town itself. They're the ones with the most power, the most influence, and they set the tone and make up the rules of the game. These wealthy families and networks pass this along heir to heir, generation to generation, safeguarding their power and wealth and status. That's their only goal in mind, ever. And you are either born into this or you marry into it. And then below that, and this will be kind of the middle layer, the next layer, and those are the people who manage the oil money games and all of their volatility. They are new money folks who are paid handsomely by the old money folks, which makes it hard to tell the difference between the two of them. They dress, speak, vote, and pray the same way. If you get close enough, though, if you get close enough, you can indeed feel the difference between the two. Under that new money second tier middle layer is a current of desperation that courses through their veins, a desperation to keep up with the Joneses, to protect the hand that feeds them. This layer, they spend their asses off to live the high life side by side with the top layer. And when times are tough and the money runs thin, some of these folks will do anything short of murder to keep their wealth intact. They, honestly, are the most frightening of the stack. And then you've got us people, us folks there at the bottom of this oil derrick hierarchy, the base layer. The base layer is the mud, the blood, and the beer. You know, the blue collar workers, the ones who keep it all running. They break a sweat daily, and some of them even their backs, because it is hard work and it requires even harder people to work it. Their numbers, of course, far exceed the other layers, but when they bring themselves together to demand a bigger piece of the pie that they worked so hard for, they are shut down and shut out and replaced by those who stay silent and grateful for the crumbs that they get. Plus, they have mouths to feed and lights that need to stay on. Light that only shines on their feet, taking one step at a time, hoping to get closer to that unlit American dream that they hope is waiting for them. It's just one step away. One step away until the day they retire or die, and another one takes their place. Okay, I went off on a tangent, and I hope I didn't lose you there. I know it's also just a snapshot, a generalization, and at the end of the day, I've done some reading. I've read Steinbeck, and I agree with him when he says, there ain't no sin and there ain't no virtue. There's just the stuff that people do, and that's just that. And that there are stories of folks on every layer and in every layer that are compelling and are human-driven, and I know that. This is a generalization, but it is a true one. And that's just that part of it. We're talking about murder. And so, of course, that isn't just good enough for me. But I'm sure you're asking, how does all of what I said, how is that relevant to the murder of Debbie and Sandy in 1985? So take all that I told you in mind. And now let's look at Baytown during the 1980s. And what could have happened to create an environment where people do desperate acts and dirty deeds? So in the early 80s, oil towns like Baytown took a hard financial hit due to an oil glut that resulted in a colossal drop in oil prices. Their economic foundation was rocked hard. Businesses shut down. There were layoffs by the hundreds. Unemployment climbed up to 9%. And in 1985, the year the women were murdered, was when folks really started to feel it. Oil town people were hurting for money, and that was on every layer. When that happens, illegal activity spikes, and every layer is somehow involved in it. When there is a financial crisis in Texas, things tend to get muddy. Businessmen become outlaws, and outlaws follow money, and death surely follows outlaws. So unfortunately, back then, during the oil glut, in places like Baytown and Chambers County, bones coming up and out of their swampy pits seems to fit right as rain. And sadly, oftentimes in the wake of outlaws, women's lives are served up as collateral damage. And that's what seems to have happened to Debbie and Sandy. They got tangled up with local men who were using illegal means to fund their businesses. And that's just what happened. To get a little further into this, we want to look at these illegal means. Typically, and in this case, it includes gambling operations, prostitution and sex trafficking, and illegal narcotics, importation, manufacturing, and delivering, all things we know. These are called the vice industries. That's what Texas likes to call them, is the Texas vice industries. So a little about that. In the past, Texas had vice districts in almost every city, and they ran with very little oversight. It wasn't until after the 1940s and World War II that most of them were shut down, all of them with the exception of businesses in Galveston, Texas. Vice industries there remained open for another decade or so until all the major gaming figures moved to Las Vegas and abandoned Galveston. And then by 1950s, the vice industries were completely outlawed. And what the past has taught us is that is when organized crime grows. When there's prohibition, organized crime grows rapidly. And the thing is Texas lawmakers know that. And some of them have made a lot of money that way. But that's a conversation for another day. So back to Baytown 1980s, we know that there was gambling going on. We know that Bobby Jarvis, Bob Bass was in it, Jimmy Tippett. I really wanted to understand what gambling looked like. I've never been much of a gambler with the exception of going to the casinos. It's just not something that's for me. But let's look at bookmaking because I wanted to know more about that. For those of you who don't know, a bookmaker is an organization or a person that accepts and pays out bets on sporting events and other agreed upon odds. A good bookmaker adjusts the odds in their favor, paying out amounts using odds that are less than what they determine to be the true odds, or by having what we all know as a point spread. Their goal, the bookmaker's goal, is a balanced book, either by getting an equal number of bets for each possible outcome or by getting the amounts wagered on each outcome to reflect the odds. Bookmakers don't try to make money from the bets themselves, but rather by acting as a market maker and profiting from the event regardless of the outcome. For anyone that knows anything about insurance, a bookie is like an actuary. It's a person who deals with measurement and management of risk and uncertainty. It's the same sort of model, really. And of course, it sounds simple enough, but when you dig into the mathematics of bookmaking, it was way over my head. So further know that gambling's not my thing. But here's a little about bookmaking in Baytown. On November 5th, 1984, none other than Jimmy Tippett was arrested with felony charges for a bookmaking operation. And you know who that is. If you recall, he was the informant. Though it seems, of course, he could have been peddling lies just like the rest of him because he was working with other people making books. And we know that Bobby Jarvis was into bookmaking and Bob Bass tried to get on in it and he unknowingly bought bad books from him. Bob admitted that he knew very little about gambling and about the gambling business, and then after losing money, he got out of it. And this made Bobby Jarvis upset, and Bob Bass was a little scared of him because of retaliation. He also went back to that meeting that he had with him when he saw the machine gun in the corner of the room, and he remembered that in that meeting with Jarvis, Jarvis mentioned to him that he had ties to Carlos Marcello and the New Orleans Mafia. Of course, this could have been a lie. You never know with Jarvis. And Bob Bass stated, like, he could have been just showboating, but here's the thing, you never know. Bobby Jarvis had ties to many bars in Crosby and Baytown and even Seabrook. And gambling was an element of his illegal activities as well as drugs, which we know. Some of his bars had topless dancers. He had a strip club in Crosby, and the Palms Oasis, of course, which was next to a no-tell motel, had topless dancers, and we can assume why that was all set up that way. We know that Jarvis was partners with Jim Gerace, an accountant by trade, and Nick Listy, who was also a businessman. Together, they owned a few bars, including Nicky D's, that was gone after by Pastor Mark Brister for their lewd activity. And then, of course, Duke's Club that later became Texas Saloon. Jarvis was also connected to MT David Ahmad, who had business ties with Mayor Hutto. So check this out. I recently found out something interesting about Mr. Ahmad. He was part of a real estate group. He's still a part of a real estate group led by Dr. Muhammad Athari and his company, Athari Real Estate LLC. And they own Magic Island out in Houston. And y'all folks from Houston know what I'm talking about. But for those who don't, here's the deets on Magic Island. Magic Island was a venue that opened in 1984. And it's this really cool building with a large pharaoh's head on top of it that still peers over Highway 59. Side note, I had my 8th birthday party there, and I begged to go because in the commercials, it made it seem like you'd have this like Indiana Jones type experience with secret passageways and mystery, and I don't know, maybe I thought I'd find gold or something, but what it really was this Las Vegas style spot with magic shows, dining, and drinking. All I remember about my party there was watching Miss Texas do a ventriloquist act and dancing with a mummy. Come to find out, the spot was really just an illegal gambling setup, and at least that was the underground intention of it. The building took a big hit from Hurricane Ike in 2008 and the subsequent fire. The Magic Island building has been vacant for a very long time. In 2018, the Ultimate Poker Club, or River Oaks Poker Club at Magic Island, was registered there. And at that time, the Athari Group took out a bunch of money to refurb it. And then that never happened. The word is now in Houston, these rumors keep popping up, but the word in Houston is that they are planning to reopen this summer in 2024, but as a private VIP type party spot and, surprise, surprise, a gambling venue. Owner David Athari also owns and has owned a slew of medical clinics all around Houston and Baytown, like almost 100 of them. And I don't know about you, I am always inclined to think that gambling and other illegal activities go hand in hand. You typically don't have one without the other, if you know what I mean. That story, of course, is for another day as well. But let's get back to Baytown in the 1980s. I came to find out that other local bars were in on the gambling scene. You have the network-owned bars, but then there's also Chapter 2 Nightclub, owned by BJ Booth. I brought it up before. That is where Gary Odom first met Debbie Merritt. BJ Booth was registered to the same building as Jim Gerace and David Pryor, a relative of Bob Bass. It makes me think that Gerace could have been an accountant for them all. Who knows? That building now has in it some sketchy-looking church that probably also needs to be looked into. So gambling was a thing. It's still a thing for sure. And it is still illegal in the state of Texas, minus some loopholes. But like I mentioned, one illegal industry hardly ever serves as a standalone. Illegal narcotics and trafficking, that goes with it. And that's the big stuff, right? That's the dangerous stuff. That's the stuff that was happening big time in Baytown during the 1980s. And we've dug into several big organizations that could have provided those party favors for the network of bar owners to peddle. And there's more to that story. Now, that story we will resume in our next episode because I'm checking things out and we are way out of time. So I'm going to leave you with that. Next episode, we're going to dig into who was supplying drugs, who was bringing them in. And that comes with several stories, actually, and we're going to try and pack them into one on the next episode. But for now, this one is done. I'm Jen Schaefer, and this is Crude Acts Murder in an Oil Town, Who Killed Debbie and Sandy. We're a small crew here at Crude Acts. Russell Dunlap is our sound and music guy. Amy Dunlap is the manager. I research, write, and host this thing. The original music you hear is by Two Star Symphony. They are homegrown right here in Houston. I want to say thank you to Bob Bass for speaking with me. He didn't have to do that. And he was so open and he cleared up a lot of things. We had an idea of the truth. You just helped bring it home. So thank you. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in. And stay tuned for the next episode. Be sure to like and subscribe where you listen, Spotify, Apple, YouTube, our website, www.crudeacts.com. And for our contributing monthly subscribers, I haven't forgotten about you. You will get some extra fun stuff that we are developing. I know I've talked about t-shirts. I have a lot to do. I admit it. But we also want to develop some case files with information of your very own so you can research with us and maybe even contribute in a bigger way. So stay tuned. That is all we have for now. I'm pooped, and I'm sure you are too. We will see you next time. All right, bye-bye.